We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses. There is so much information out there tailored towards service providers, so we have carved out a space just for you. The creative entrepreneurs making and selling physical goods. We're firm believers that everyone has a story to share, and there is so much we can learn from each other's business journey. Whether you are just starting out or a seasoned business owner, this podcast will shed light on new strategies, inspiration, and action steps to help you grow your product-based business. Hey friends, I'm Katie Hunt, and today on the show, I have Amber Kemp Gerstle. She's the founder and creative director of Damask Love, a creative lifestyle blog all about doable DIY. Damask Love has partnered with brands like Martha Stewart, Home Depot, Container Store, Canon, and more. This woman is a powerhouse. In addition to the content creation arm of Damask Love, Amber has a physical product line of crafting supplies that are exclusively available at Joann Fabric and craft stores. And Amber is the social media face of the Joann brand. Amber recently launched a second brand called Yay Day Paper Company. It's a digital subscription service that offers delightfully designed stationery, craft products, and planner goodies that everyone can print from home. And you might recognize Amber from NBC's TV show, Making It. She was a finalist in their 2018 season. And she's the host of Disney Family Sundays on Disney Plus. She's also been featured in magazines like Parents Magazine, Better Home and Garden, Domino Magazine, and more. On today's episode, Amber and I are talking about her business model, specifically when she actively decided to turn her hobby blog into a business and how she did it. We talk about her new company, Yay Day Paper Co., and why she chose to create digital products under that brand and also leverage a subscription model. Amber also shares her experience of being a woman of color in an industry that lacks diversity. She talks about why representation matters and ways that our creative community can uplift other artists, crafters, and makers of color. Amber's list of accomplishments is long and impressive. I greatly admire how she's built this business, and I know you're going to learn a lot from her today as you listen in. So let's dive in. Amber, thank you so much for being here today. I'm excited to chat with you.
I'm so excited to chat with you. I think this was like the match made in heaven.
I know, right? Well, I had to laugh a little bit when I read your bio online about your mother paying your allowance in stickers and stationery when you were a child, because I had a similar experience. I occasionally worked at my mom's law firm in the summers, and at the end of the day, they let me loose in the supply closet so that I could collect my pay. And I'm using pay in quotes here, you know, like they give me a manila envelope and I load up with pens. But
I completely relate.
Well, hey, you are a multifaceted entrepreneur. You have a product line through your brand, Yay Day Paper Co. Your blog, Damask Love, is a popular crafting site. You're a brand ambassador, speaker, and you've been on TV shows like Making It and Disney's Family Sundays, right? Is that how it's called?
Family Sundays. You got it.
Very cool. So this is an impressive portfolio. How did you go from having a PhD in family and child psychology to being such a strong force in the crafting world?
I think, well, I'll be honest, I didn't do it intentionally. I very much started, every piece of what I do now was started as a hobby with no intention of making it a job. I grew up with my mom, who was like, the expectation was like, well, are you going to be a doctor or are you going to be a lawyer? Like, these are your choices. Right. And so I kind of, I don't know, like I became a psychologist, which I suppose is more the doctor route, but I did that because that was the expectation. But I've always been such a creative person. So once I finished graduate school and was working as a psychologist, I started a blog as a hobby to just have this creative outlet. But I think I'm just one of those people who kind of can't just, like, enough is never enough. And so I just kept working at it. And then it kind of turned itself, you know, I've just never had a hobby that stayed a hobby. It always turns into like a little business. Even when I was a kid, I would like try to sell my stickers. Everything turned into a business. So as Damask Love, you know, as the content grew and people started to notice it more, I was like, well, maybe I can make money off this. But I always knew I had to be strategic with how I did that, and knew that I had to have a kind of specific point of view. And I think the turning point for me was when I was approached by a brand for a contract for 6 months that was going to pay me $18,000. And that just sounded like the most money ever.
Right.
And I was like, well, if people are paying this kind of money, well, then I just need enough people to pay me $18,000 and I can quit my job.
Right.
So kind of with that plan in mind, went forward and saved up money. And then with the support of my husband, who, unlike me, grew up with a family of entrepreneurs who very much value the entrepreneurial spirit, he totally backed me and supported me. And I left my job as a psychologist and went ahead and was like, I'm going to give myself a year and see if this blog thing works out. And it did.
That's awesome. We are so cut from the same cloth. I felt the same way growing up as a kid. I would make friendship bracelets and sell them on the street or like, you know, and two, I worked in the corporate world for a long time. It sounds like you had some overlap then with you starting the blog while you were also still in practice, right?
Yeah, I worked for University of Miami, and I remember when they announced every psychologist in the department would be getting two monitors, like you would have the dual monitors for your desk.
Yeah.
And so they delivered the second monitor, and literally I'd be sitting at my desk, and I joke, it was like literal left side, right, left brain, right brain. My left side of my computer would be like, I'd be writing a psychology evaluation report, and the right side of right monitor would be Damask Love, like checking in on stats. Like it was my face was split between these two things while I was still working full time. And it, at a certain point, it just became too much.
Of course. I remember those days of just feeling like my brain's going to explode if I keep this up. So, okay, let's dig into your business model, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Your blog, Damask Love, has a large and dedicated audience. You know, it was named a top DIY blog by Better Home and Gardens, as well as Domino Magazine. At what point did you tell yourself, okay, like you've already said that you made the decision you were going to give it a year, but there had to have been like a light bulb moment where it said, okay, this is more than a hobby. I really want to monetize this. Was it that $18,000 experience or was it a trickle of things?
I think it was an $18,000 experience that opened my eyes to the fact that people were willing to pay significant amounts of money. Because before that time, I had done, and I know your audience will understand this, because in the crafting industry, and I might make some people mad when I talk about this, but I'm not, that's fine with me. But in the crafting industry, we have this model where people apply for design teams or people apply for ambassadorships and you get paid with product or you get paid with every month receiving a new shipment of whatever's new. And I always, the entire time I was very much entrenched because I started out as very much part of the crafting. I was a stamper. I made cards, like, that was what I did. But the entire time I did that and worked on design teams, I always felt like if I'm going to work for free, I should choose exactly who I'm going to work for free for, because everybody wants free work. So I can work for a company that will send me free product, or I can work for free for a company that might give me a little bit of leverage. I can work for free for Better Homes and Gardens and get myself placement in a magazine. I can work for free for Martha Stewart Living, which I did for a period of time, because that would get me placement in high SEO value places on the web. So I was really strategic about who I worked for free for, because I think sometimes, especially within crafting, we think that like you have to stay in that crafting niche, but frankly, like it's so far reaching. You know, the people who read Better Homes and Gardens, they want to know how to make a card too. So why not reach those people too?
So when you say you worked for free, were they coming to you and asking you, or were you just proactively on your blog talking about things you knew that they would be interested in and tagging them and cross-linking them? Like, what was your strategy there? What was the first step?
It was both. I would reach out. I spent a lot of time reaching out to brands saying like, I sent countless emails about, I love this product. Would you be willing to send it to me? I love this. I must have sent hundreds of that email. And so, yes, I spent a lot of time reaching out to people and getting product and kind of product sponsorships that way. And then people approached me, because a lot of big companies, they want great content, but they do not want to pay for it. And so they have to be like, they're not at that point. My following was small enough to where like I wasn't going to get paid a ton. And so I was more willing to work for less. So it was twofold, but I did send a lot of these pitch emails asking for free products for giveaways, free product that I could use in a project. One of the funny things I did was way back in the day, and I'm pretty sure the blog post is still on Damask Love, I reached out to Joanne Fabric and Craft Stores because I wanted a $50 gift card to buy some product for a Christmas craft. And girl, I had to go through so many loops and hoops and jump so many hurdles to get this $50 gift card. And finally I got it. And over the years, that literally starting with that free gift card, that turned into, over the last few years, been essentially like the social media voice and face for Joann Craft Stores. My product is carried exclusively in Joann Craft Stores. I've developed a relationship with them. I mean, I'm their highest paid influencer. I like have direct lines of contact with some of the more influential people in the company. Like that relationship has truly grown into something that's so meaningful for me and hopefully for that company as well.
But at the same time, it's funny to look back and think, oh my God, I had to scratch my way to the top of that, right?
No, I was convincing those people, like, give me this $50, please.
Right, $50. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. So did those kind of like sponsorships and affiliates on the blog kind of lead into more of these brand ambassador opportunities for you?
I think once you start having a presence and showing that you do sponsor content, that companies work with you in that way, then that kind of brings in more of that. They know that, oh, this person does do sponsored content, and then they're more comfortable reaching out to you for other projects.
Right. Because you have partnered with dozens of brands, including Martha Stewart, Home Depot, Container Store, mm-hmm. Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. Canon. I mean, Joann's too, you mentioned. So like, I assume there's a bit of momentum that you get going as you start to do more of this and they see you working with other brands. But like, are you still proactively, I mean, you have a large following now. Are you still proactively mm-hmm. pitching these types of opportunities or are they more coming to you?
You know, I'll be 100% honest with you. So I don't pitch much anymore. I'm very, very blessed to be in a situation where companies will approach me for content. Every so often I do, at this point, I work with a management agency. I have a manager who she and I will discuss, like, are there people that you want to be working with? Are there projects mm-hmm. that you have going? And we will reach out to them and kind of pitch them on maybe working with me. But a lot of the content that I do is people who reached out to me. I've now gotten to a position where I can say yes or say no to the brands that fit best with what I want to create.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. I say no to a good bit of things for lots of reasons. So that, I think over time, I've been able to kind of get that, be in that position. But that's not where it always started. I've probably as recently as maybe two or three years ago, I was sending out a lot of emails to mm-hmm. pitch people and see if they would be willing to work with me.
And in those pitches, thinking back on those, were you specific mm-hmm. in the type of projects you wanted to do with them? Or like, were they more general pitches? What did you find most effective in those early days?
I will tell you exactly what I did. And sometimes people don't agree with this approach, but it works for me. I really believe that when you're sending a pitch to a company or a brand or whomever, you have to give them no reason to say no. Like, you have to feed them all the information and make it so easy for them to say yes. Like, when I send a pitch, it is fully baked. Like, this is what I'm going to do. These are the products I want to use. These are the deliverables I would provide to you. I send a media kit that gives, my media kit always includes information about my numbers. It includes testimonials from things people have said about past content I've created. It's usually about, the pitch ends up being about 3 pages and it's fully baked out. Now, a lot of times people say to me, well, once you give them that, couldn't they just take it?
And that's where I was going to go with this too. Like, how do you protect that idea?
I have never had that issue. I think for a couple of reasons. One, the thing that I'm offering to do is something that's very unique to what I do. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yes. Could you find somebody else to replicate it? I suppose, but that seems like, again, I've just given it to you fully baked out. All you have to do is say yes, and I can be the one to execute it.
Right.
Secondly, I have been told on several occasions by brands that I work with that, one, they hire me for the quality of content that I create. But beyond that, like, there's just an unspoken value that comes with hiring me, like the voice, the personality, and that just can't be replicated. And that's right. The same for every other person, every other content creator. You can't replicate those things. So sure, you can take my idea, but you can't put those unspoken qualities into it. You can't package those with it. And those have a value. So
yeah,
that's what makes me and other people who bring their own special something. Well, that's what makes the competition irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
Like at that point, it doesn't matter what someone else is offering because they cannot replicate those things about you.
I agree with you. I also think, too, as a creative, you constantly have new and innovative ideas, right? So, no one, nobody can replicate it like you can. But two, nobody's going to put together that proposal like you. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to. And if somebody did run away with that, like, I'd be annoyed. I'd be really angry about it. But at the same time, I know that I'd create something new for somebody else. Or, you know, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The wheels are always turning, right? Like, yeah. You're always coming up with something. And frankly, like, there's a book called, I mention it all the time. It's called Blue Ocean Strategy. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how the world of commerce is a red ocean. I mean, that's kind of what we do. We create competition. They're like, when one salon opens, are they going to be the only person given blowouts? No, somebody else is going to open the exact same concept and maybe they'll tweak it. And so we're constantly having, like, it is our job. Yep. As entrepreneurs. You have to continually make yourself different and reinvent your ideas, or else it doesn't matter if you give all your ideas away, because once they're run out, like, you're out of business. You have to constantly be concerned about what your next strategy is. That's just the name of the game whenever you're doing anything in business.
I 100% agree. I'm over here nodding my head yes, like it's gonna fall off. I also want to go back to the fact that, like, I love the idea that you presented a fully fleshed out, like, proposal for these people with the idea from the start. Like, I do understand the idea of, like, well, let's send, like, a brand book first and talk about potential ideas, but nothing specific, because it protects your ideas. However, as somebody that receives a lot of pitches and works with a lot of different people, if I receive a full pitch that says, here's what I want to come on the podcast and I want to talk about this, this, and this, I can be like, yep, that works for my audience, yeah, or that works, yeah, for me, or that fits with what we're doing. So yeah, let's get you on. Whereas if somebody pitches me, and this is obviously a different scenario, but like if they pitch me and it's more of a loose, like, well, let's work together, and mm-hmm, I kind of have this background, mm-hmm, it's not a hell yes at that point. And so,
yeah, I think one thing I think this has helped me too, is that once you've worked and seen, it's like, once you've seen how the sausage is made with brands, and yeah, you know, the inner workings of how those marketing teams work. Like, at first you may have this idea that the marketing team is some powerful machine. The marketing team is usually like one or two people who are stretched pretty thin, and yep, they would love nothing more than to have a qualified person come in with an idea that's fully fleshed out and make their job easier, because they already have too many things to do. And so they're, for the most part, in my experience, they're not in the business of taking your idea and then creating more work for themselves to recreate it.
Right. Like,
just, yeah, I love this idea. Take it, do it. Yes.
I know. I talk about this a lot in the product world of, like, make it easy for your customers to buy from you, whether it's on the wholesale side or the retail side, make it simple. And it's the same way too, when you're pitching for these types of partnerships or sponsorships or anything like that, make it simple for them. And yes, make it easy for them to say yes, as you said.
Yes. So, yeah.
All right, let's talk about Yayday Paper Co. Your business model is built entirely off of digital products and leveraging a subscription model, correct?
Yep, yeah, that's it.
Okay, this fascinates me, because this isn't a widely practiced business model in our product world. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of different ways that you could build the product side. Why digital and why a subscription model?
So a few things. Going way back to when I started my blog and business, I started out stamping and making cards. And I remember, for all of the people listening who have done this, who are card makers and stampers, you know that when you make a card, you will sit and think about that thing for hours, right? It'll, yeah, take you forever to make. And I remember when I was doing that, I would always get friends telling me, oh, Amber, when are you going to start selling these? When are you going to start selling these? And I always, in the back of my head, was like, if you knew how much time it took me to make this card, you would never pay how much I would have to charge you. The ROI is impossible for this type of a product. Like, I would have to charge you $30, and no one's buying a $30 card.
Right.
So I always knew that if I was ever going to sell in the paper craft kind of industry, I was either going to have to manufacture at such a large scale to make it profitable, or I was going to have to figure out some way to make that product scalable so that it could reach a lot of people without too much difficulty. So I knew that from the beginning. I wasn't sure what it would look like. Now, mm-hmm, down the road, I ended up, Damask Love ended up signing licensing for a physical product. So Damask, mm-hmm, Love has physical product that's available in Office Depot, planners, pens, stickers. I have things in Joanne. I will be soon launching fabric. So I have physical product that's available. And once I saw how the physical product world works and all the things that have to happen, all the things you have to consider, the taxes and the fees of getting it over the water. Then you have to figure out how much profit can you make from it and how much quantity and minimum order quantities and all of those things that you have to think about. And then even once you've met those requirements, you're still limited on distribution, on who you can actually get your product to. Yeah. And for me, I've always been such a proponent of accessibility. And when I saw how tough it was at times for people who really wanted my product to get it because they were in another country or because shipping was too expensive, I knew that, okay, digital is a way that I can get this to people. Yeah. And having done physical product, I knew that all the stuff I made started out as a digital design. Like, the only thing we were doing for you was printing it out. And that was something, yeah, I knew I could teach someone else to do. So like by empowering people to turn the digital product into physical product themselves,
yeah,
I knew that I could reach a lot more people.
Well, and not to mention the experience for them, like the customer experience. Like, some people, especially your audience, love that tactile experience of mm-hmm. printing it out and creating it themselves. So,
right. It's part of the crafting. And I knew that, like, at first I was like, is this going to be too hard for the end user? But I felt like, you know, if Cricut can have a machine, if printers are being sold in the world, if Kinko's can exist, then this concept can happen, because people are already doing this thing. It's a tool that people are already familiar with. People have a printer, or at least they've heard of one. Mm. And so if I can empower them to think of that machine as a crafting tool and give them beautiful things to just print off with it, then I've kind of like reinvented this component of crafting that maybe didn't so much exist as strongly before. So that was kind of where the idea of digital came from, because I really wanted people to access it. And it's incredible. I mean, it's crazy. Like, we release a digital collection at midnight. By 6 a.m., someone in Australia is printing it. Wow. You know, it's just incredible to see.
How impactful for you to see that work. Like,
no, it's crazy. Like, I'm like, how is this happening? Like, literally 3 hours ago, I was the only person on planet Earth who had this product. Right. And now, just hours later, people all over the world are using it. So I always get excited when I see subscribers. We use Stripe for payment processing. So I can see where people are paying from. And it's like England, Germany, Italy. Like, it's crazy. It's all over the world. And it's so nice to know that these people don't have to pay more shipping. They're paying the same thing that we're paying here in the States for the same product and having access to it. So that was one of the things that really made me believe in the digital piece. Now, the subscription piece was purely a scalability thing.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a smart way to scale it.
Yeah. It's all about scaling.
Totally. And I will say too, I mean, you're in a different position than a lot of our listeners that might be listening right now, in that you have a much larger following. But what are some steps that they can take, even with a smaller, more engaged following, to be marketing their products, whether it's physical or digital? What kind of things have you been leveraging that would work for them too?
So I think, well, one thing, yes, I have a large following, but I think sometimes, especially because my business model is a little, like, it's not something you see a lot of.
Right. It's fascinating.
I don't want people to get the misconception that this was like an overnight success. This is a hustle every single day to like educate people and get people to understand how this works. And so I have access to a large following, but it was not like a million people signed up on day one. That's not it. We work every day.
And I didn't mean to imply that you're like living the cush life now.
I think it's helpful to hear that, though, because yes, I know is. Often I hear people who I envision as having very large followings and having a big business, and they'll talk about all these successes, but they don't talk about like the real nitty gritty of it. And the truth of the matter is, like, if we can get to 500 subscribers by the end of 2020, I'll be happy. We have other components of the business that aren't subscription, but if we can get to 500 by the end of the year, that would be really, I would feel very good about that. Every subscriber is just such a meaningful commitment to somebody, you know, like that really means a lot.
The other thing, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the other thing is, you're in like an educational spin right now too, mm-hmm. because this is not something that is commonly done, especially in our world. And so you're having to educate people on why they would want to do this mm-hmm. before they mm-hmm. can then get comfortable as to signing up.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I have to... It's one thing to provide the product, but I have to teach you how to use it. Like, here are the things that you can do. Exactly. And here are the benefits and here's why it would be helpful. Like, that's the bigger piece than just creating the product. But I would say for people, whether you're a small, like you're a smaller business or you're just getting started and you're curious about the marketing strategies, there's a few things that I try to think about. So I really believe that people buy stories before they buy products. They buy personal experiences. They buy a why rather than a what. So for me, the story of Yayday is very authentic and very true. You know, I wanted a way to reach people. I wanted a way to make things accessible because I know there are people who either live in an area, like crafting stores have closed, right? Like stationery shops are closing everywhere. We don't have them anymore. We don't get that so much anymore. And it's frustrating. So I wanted to see how can I replicate that, but also be mindful of the world we live in, the digital world. Right. And then also, I really believe in diversity and representation. And I know that in the world of manufacturing, when the minimum order quantity is 10,000, I feasibly am not going to order 10,000 greeting cards that feature a Black woman's face because stores probably aren't going to pick it up. Like, they're just not going to put it on their shelves because they don't know if they can move that quantity of product. But in digital, I can make 20 different skin tones because it costs me the same. So that's the story of it. The thing that you get at the end is the same every time. It's a print, but there's a story there. So I would encourage really like dig in and sit down and really think, whether it's writing a mission statement, whether it's writing just a, like a manifesto, whatever you want to call it, for what makes your story unique. Because using greeting cards as the example, We're all selling greeting cards, but there's a reason why yours has a special meaning or has something that really speaks to someone. And that's the story. And I think that that is a huge piece of marketing.
I agree with you. And the story of why you got into this business in the first place. I mean, there's so many different backgrounds and ideas and reasons why they have decided to get into the business, but then also to create that one individual product as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I'm always thinking about when it comes to marketing is making your customer or your end user the hero of that story. And these are, by the way, these are not things I came up with. Like, these are just things I've read in many of the marketing books I've read. But it's hard because we spend so much time developing and working and building these things that in the end, we want to give ourselves this huge pat on the back. And we have to kind of fight that urge because once it lands in the customer's hands, they are now the hero of that story. They are, because they are the ones who heard your story and decided to act on it. So when I market and when I talk about Yayday, I have to remember that the people using it are way smarter than I am. Like, they're way more creative. They're coming up with ideas I never thought I could come up with. They are the ones who are selling this for me, because once I'm done creating, I'm like so exhausted. Like, I need their help to really... to sell this. And so I'm always like, you know, making sure that I honor and value the customer and make her the hero of whatever inspired me to start the story to begin with. I think that's a big piece.
I love that. I in my coaching world, I try to do the same in terms of the storytelling, but also like showcasing the different people in my community and the amazing products and services that they're creating and the brands they're building. Just like you are going to, I'm sure you are, highlighting the people that are using your kits and your products. And I think, like you said, making them the hero of it, because you may have provided something for them, but they took it that extra mile. They, you know, whether it's information or a crafting product, like, they utilize that to create something new. And I think that's the most exciting
thing. And when you do that, your customers, I even hate using the word customers, because they stop being customers and they start being like part of the movement. They start being part of the family and the community. And you're in this together. And that, I think, is when you really start to see your business change and grow, is when people feel like they belong to a community rather than they're just like, it's just transactional.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Okay. You have openly shared in the past that you haven't always felt seen or included in your industry. How do you make your voice heard despite the lack of diversity and visibility for women of color in this crafting world?
So it's funny. So I always say that God set my volume on high, like when I was being made. So me being heard has never been a problem. Like, I'm just the type of person who, if I need to, I will talk louder than the people who don't want me to be heard. and I will say the things that people can't believe I'm going to say. That has never been an issue for me. But because of that, I do feel a duty to use that to make sure that people who are not like me are seen and heard, because I'm certainly not dumb enough to not realize that within our industry of crafting, that for a very long time, if something was going to be a flesh tone meant that you were going to be white and have blonde or brown hair. And I'm aware and I see that. And so I need to use my loud voice to draw attention to it and encourage designers to think differently when illustrating or representing different people. So I've absolutely seen a shift, but I think my job, my duty is to be seen. Like, there is a reason why when you go into Office Depot or when you go into Joanne and my product is on the shelf, there is a reason why my picture is next to it. And that's not on accident. That is because there is a little girl somewhere. There is a mom somewhere. There is somebody who needs to know who made this product, because it's somebody who doesn't look like everybody else.
Yeah.
And so those are very intentional things that I make a point to do to make sure that I'm the face behind the products that I put out there. Because while my voice is plenty loud, I'm not going to be around forever. I'm going to be old and not cute enough to do this anymore at some point. So somebody else is going to have to take my place. And I would very much love for someone else to feel like she had an example or feels empowered to, oh, I can be a crafter for a living too. We should all see ourselves in every industry, right? Like,
yes.
We should see a dentist who looks like us. We should see a marine biologist who looks like us. We should see it. So, because when you see it, you know it's possible. You see yourself in that. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about redheads with freckles. I'm talking about everybody. We should really see ourselves and know people who look like us. And it's important for children and people in the majority to see people who do not look like them in those roles. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense.
Like,
yes.
We need to know that it's possible, but other people need to know that it's possible, I guess.
100% agree with you. You know, what are ways, and I don't mean to put the burden on you to give us examples or solutions, but what are the ways that the creative community can better support, uplift, you know, crafters, artists, and makers of color? I mean, what proactive steps do you recommend for those of us that want to be a good ally?
Yeah. So I'll start with one that I always think of, but I forget to mention. It's a little lighthearted, but it's true. Don't wait till February to start highlighting makers
please.
Of color. Like, it does not have to be Black History Month for you to, like, every year in February or, like, right around the end of January, I get an email that's like, we'd love to include you in a roundup. And I'm like, yes, of course you would, because you need content for February. So I would first be very aware of not doing that. But more so, I think, you know, there's one of the things I've heard lots of graphic designers and illustrators say to me personally is that I've helped them rethink how they illustrate things. Like, there is no reason. Flesh tone is just not one color. Like, right. There's no reason why you can't feature many of them in anything you're drawing. So I would encourage anyone who is in that line of work to kind of just rethink how you, when you put pen to paper, what you're putting there and not defaulting necessarily to a Caucasian face. Next, I would say, when we think of the people who represent our industry and who we hire and how we put teams together, like, remember that when you put together an all-white team of women, often heads don't really turn. Like, people are just kind of like, oh, that's fine. But if the reverse happened and it was an all Black team of women, the assumption might be, oh, well, this must be a Black thing, or this must be this must be for African American History Month. So I would encourage people to just diversify and include, not only check off the box of diversity, but also make sure you're including a wide range, not just Black women, not just white women. I'm talking about men who are often not represented in the crafting industry.
Right.
I would encourage you to just be very aware of it and know that. I think one thing that's kind of a struggle is thinking that if you're doing it with intention, that it's somehow tokenism. But I think that in order for it to become habit, you have to exercise that muscle, and it has to be intentional for a while, right?
Absolutely.
You have to intentionally seek out and say, no, I'm going to search and search and search until I find a man and a Black woman or a Hispanic woman or an Asian woman to fill these positions. And you have to be intentional about it until it just becomes second nature. I wouldn't kind of beat yourself up about the fact that that falls in the category of tokenism. I would say something else I've heard a lot of people kind of worry about. I've had lots of conversations about this with lots of companies lately. is the fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing and getting it wrong. Yeah, that's what's going to happen. But we are in the season of being uncomfortable. And, you know, I think that there's been lots of people in this world who have lived lives of discomfort through disenfranchisement and other forms of systemic oppression. And so, you know, let's just join together in that discomfort and know that you might say something wrong. You might offend someone, and your wrongness or your mistake is going to be met with varying levels of grace and tolerance. And you may get pushback. And it's like, it's my job to meet you with grace and tolerance and kind of try to steer the vision maybe in the right direction. And it's your job to just continue to be uncomfortable and get it wrong from time to time. Like, we're just going to both be in this dance of getting it wrong and fixing it, but not doing anything because you're uncomfortable or afraid is just, that is not, I don't think, the answer.
I've felt the same way as I've watched and listened. I tried to speak out early on about where my business stood and how it was a place for them to be included. I'm going to make mistakes along the way. Mm-hmm. I know that, but I feel like it's important to be listening, learning, all the things that you've mentioned already. But that not taking action piece that you talked about, like, that was never a thought for me. I just appreciate your thoughts on this. And
yeah,
it is something we're all a work in progress on. I'm a work in progress on, I guess, is more mm-hmm. what I should address.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think when the George Floyd murder happened, I kind of went into this like place probably for like a week or more of just not knowing. I know I'm not alone in this, but I was very much just like, don't know what to do. Don't know what to say. Really like vacillating between anger and hurt and sadness and feeling like this is just so big. Like, what we're up against is so big, right? Like, we talk about the system being broken. I would argue the system is not broken. Frankly, the system is working exactly how it was designed to work. Mm-hmm. And that makes this feel insurmountable. This feels too big for me. And right. The point at which I was able to come out of that was like, okay, I can't take on the burden of the whole thing because then it's impossible. So where is my little piece of this? And what is my voice going to be used for? I read a meme that said, we all have our roles in the revolution, right? Somebody's going to get angry and protest. Somebody's going to make sandwiches. So we all have our role. You know, I knew that in the crafting community and in the maker space, I have a voice that can be meaningful and impactful. And that's what I'm going to work on. I can't do everything else. I can't fix everything else. I'm probably not the best person to go speak in front of my congressman or write letters to politicians. That's not my skill, but I do have a skill that would allow me to impact this industry. And yes. So that's what I'm going
to
do.
I think that's great advice too, for those of us to listening, just to do the things that we can practically do where we can make the biggest difference. Can I ask another question about who in the creative community do you look up to and seek inspiration from?
So I get that question a lot. And one of the, I've always struggled with it for years. I've struggled with that question. Like, I don't look in the creative community for inspiration. That's not to say there aren't lots of people who are very inspiring, but a lot of what I do is look just like other entrepreneurs in other industries. I love watching like a good documentary about entrepreneurship, or just like, There's a documentary about Kevin Hart, the comedian, which I know he's riddled with all sorts of controversy. But one of the things I took from it that I just was so inspiring for me is when you're an artist, a musician, a comedian, or whatever, most of the time you're under management and your management makes all the money and then they pay you, right? Like, you get some sort of royalty that's like 2 cents on the dollar. And so he just started his own production and management company. Now he owns everything. And so when I see things like that, it's just so smart. And those are the things that inspire me. The way, like, the strategic ways people build their businesses, the way they take ownership of pieces of their business. So I love reading and listening to those types of stories. That's where I get my inspiration. Because I'm like, well, I mean, if they're one person that figured it out, surely I'm one person that could figure out some of it.
Totally. Right? I agree with you. I like looking outside of our initial industry. And for me personally, outside of my coaching world, outside of my, you know, creative world, to see what are other people doing and how could I leverage some piece of that in a different way with mm-hmm. my audience. So I agree with you. I love going to conferences and reading books from people outside of my initial sphere, basically.
Yeah, like fashion, that I love Kalana Barfield. She's an amazing, she's a fashion content creator, but I think she was the editor for, I want to say InStyle. I could be wrong from that. But there's just so many people who are like making really creative moves in their business. Yeah. And I just love watching and listening to what they have to say and then figuring out how to make it apply to crafting. Crafting is just one industry, right? We can apply so many lessons to it.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Well, what are you working on right now that you can share with us?
Oh, so right now, oh my gosh. So we're in July. And right now, as you already know, I'm like knee deep in Christmas. So figuring out, yes. Like, I'm really excited because this will be the first Christmas for Yay Day Paper Co. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we offer, I'm in an interesting season because I'm trying to figure out how do we offer and represent a diverse array of holidays and skin tones within a subscription model. Because yes. Everyone who subscribes to our service does not celebrate Christmas. They do not celebrate Hanukkah. How do we offer them relevant content, but also respect the diversity of the season? So we're working on Kwanzaa, we're working on Hanukkah, we're working on Christmas, we're working on lots and lots of holiday options for Yay Day this year. So I'm excited. I'm very excited for that. Literally in the moment, I'm working on we're about to film a digital Yay Day paper craft camp mm-hmm. because so many people are staying home. So we're going to do a week long, just like creative crafts that you can make with your printer at home using Yay Day Paper Co. prints. So we're working on that. That'll launch later this month, I hope. So that's what's happening right now. My fabric, we're working on like getting that out into stores. Very excited about that. It's never a dull moment here, Katie. Never
no.
A dull
moment. No. I will say, Amber, as I was preparing for this interview, I was just so impressed with you and the business model you've created, the multiple revenue streams, how you've really taken ownership. This stuff you were talking about, oh gosh, what's the name? The actor.
Kevin Hart.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, my brain this morning. Kevin Hart, I feel the same way about you. Like you have been very strategic and thoughtful in how you've built this business and how you've managed different aspects. And it's a lot. I mean, it's yeah. multiple brands and layers of this while having a family and a personal life and everything else under the sun, you know? And so I just want to applaud you. I really admire you as a businesswoman. And it was such a joy to talk to you today. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for, you know, sharing the tactics that worked for you and also having the hard conversation with me too about what I can do to better support my community.
You don't know how much it means to hear that. I have never thought of myself as a savvy entrepreneur or businesswoman, but coming from you, I value that a lot. It's something I really do try my best. So I appreciate that feedback a lot.
It is incredibly impressive what you've built and how you have stayed true to your core values as you've built these businesses. So just know that it's seen and it's appreciated and we just adore what you're doing here. Well, before we sign off, I want to let people know where they can find you online.
Yes. Okay. The list is growing.
And we will include all of them in the show notes, but tell us where you want to send people right away.
So you can find me at Damask Love, DamaskLove, Damask Love. You can find me online. That's my website. That's all of my social handles. So everywhere, Damask Love. And then the same for Yay Day Paper Co. You can find yaydaypaper.com is the website and Yay Day Paper is the Instagram handle. So those are our two biggest channels. So easy to find me there too.
Awesome. Well, Amber, thank you so much for your time today. This was such a joy to talk to you.
Yay. Thanks so much for having me. I loved this.
Thank you. All right, friends. Isn't Amber's energy just infectious? It was really fun to talk shop with her about the different arms of her business, the different revenue streams she has, and how she has strategically and intentionally layered in all these different pieces of her business. I also want to note here that I very much appreciated her sharing her suggestions for how we can make our creative industry and our individual businesses more inclusive and diverse. This is important work that we are taking seriously here at Proof to Product, and I view this as something that I need to personally work on as an individual, but we also need to work on collectively within our industry. So I appreciated her sharing her thoughts and opinions about how we can take steps forward with grace and also recognizing that we may make mistakes along the way. I have included Amber's links in the show notes so you can access access her blog, Damask Love, and her new brand, DA Day Paper Co., and all the other places that you can connect with her on social media and online. Before we sign off, I do want to get your feedback. I'd love to get your feedback, actually. We are currently working on content planning for both the podcast and my group coaching program, Proof to Product Labs. That's where we do live trainings once a month and live group coaching calls with me once a month. And I would love to hear what you are working on and what you need help with. If you have recommendations for podcast guests or experts that you'd like to learn from, I am all ears. You can DM me on Instagram. I'm at Proof to Product, and we'll include that link in the show notes too, so you can easily switch over and send me a message. All right. Thanks for being here. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. We will be back next week with a new episode.